Sunshine, turquoise waters, and swaying palms. The Bahamas beckons with paradise. But beneath this idyllic veneer lurks the notorious Bermuda Triangle, a region where disappearances seem to occur with unnerving regularity. In 1945, a flight of Navy torpedo bombers, Flight 19, vanished on a routine training mission, swallowed whole by this sinister triangle. And they weren't alone in their fate. A rescue seaplane sent out to find them also met with the same fate, disappearing without a trace. In total, 27 men vanished, sent to Davy Jones' locker or claimed by some unknown force. But was it a tragic navigational error, a freak weather event, or something more supernatural? Welcome back to episode 31 of Super Mystery Bros, the podcast that YouTube commenter Revolta7195 called, quote, clowns, poop, caca, end quote. Speaking of listener opinions, the topic for this episode was requested by our listener Alex, who was nice enough to leave us a 5-star review and some kind words on the Apple Podcast app. Real quick though, does that mean that if you leave us a review and you'll just get to tell us what to cover in our show? Not necessarily, but if you do want to be like Alex and leave us a 5-star written review on Apple Podcasts, you can reach out to us at supermysterybrospodcast@gmail.com, and we'll highly consider any recommendations that you have for a topic in the future. I'm not going to guarantee that we're going to select your topic or even do it in a timely manner, but if it's something that we think that we'll be able to do, we'll put it into our queue. But either way, all of our listeners should aspire to be even half the man that Alex is, and look toward Revolta7195 as an example of who not to emulate.
Yeah, fuck that guy, or whoever.
Anyway, Kyle, do you have anything that you want to say up front?
No, thank you, Alex, for leaving us the 5-star and review. We hope this episode goes well for you, since it was of your choosing.
Yeah, sorry for taking so long to get to this one, Alex, but we've got to kind of space our topics out a little bit so that we have somewhat of an even rotation of topics. Before we begin tonight, I do want to provide a little bit of a disclaimer up front. While I was doing research for this episode, I noticed that trying to piece this story together using multiple different sources became nearly impossible because they all started heavily conflicting with each other. Especially when it came to like the radio dialogue aspect of things and the overall timeline of events. So what I did was I had to heavily rely on Wikipedia to try and make sense out of the story. I hope you guys can forgive me and kind of give me a pass for that on this episode. I don't normally rely on Wikipedia. So early shout out to Wikipedia, the world's most trusted source of information. All right, Kyle, are you ready to get into this one?
Yes, sir.
We begin tonight with the subject of triangles. You might remember them from your geometry class or even your trigonometry class. Isosceles, acute, or even obtuse. But having just three sides, critics might say that they're inferior to the four side having rectangles. Some scientists even speculate that you can make a rectangle by simply putting two triangles together, so therefore triangles are only half as good. However, despite the apparent superiority of rectangles, no rectangle on Earth generates quite as much intrigue or wild speculation as the most famous triangle on Earth does. The Bermuda Triangle, also known as the Devil's Triangle. The mere careless whisper of this particular triangle is enough to give any Florida man the willies and conjure up black and white images of planes and boats fading away into the twilight zone. Wild speculation of mysterious underwater alien bases, or strange magnetic interference. But just where is it exactly? Despite its fame and infamy, very few can even point to it on a map. Furthermore, experts don't even seem to agree on its exact location. You could even be sitting inside of it right now and not even know it. Kyle, please help us elucidate this baffling concept.
What does elucidate mean?
You know, to help bring it to light.
Okay. The concept of the Bermuda Triangle? Yeah, it's just, it's an area in the...
No, that's your cue to move on, man.
Oh. My bad. All right. Well, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the Bermuda Triangle is a section of the North Atlantic Ocean off North America in which more than 50 ships and 20 airplanes are said to have mysteriously disappeared. The area, whose boundaries are not universally agreed upon, has a triangular shape that reaches approximately from the Atlantic coast of Florida to the island of Bermuda, to the islands known as the Greater Antilles. Pull them up on Google Maps if you're geographically challenged like I am. Reports of unexplained occurrences in the region date to the mid-19th century. Some ships were discovered completely abandoned for no apparent reason. Others transmitted no distress signals and were never seen or heard from again. Aircraft have been reported and then vanished, and rescue missions are said to have vanished when flying in the area. However, wreckage has not been found, and some of the theories advanced to explain the repeated mysteries have been fanciful. To pass through it would mean putting your very ass on the line. Tonight, dear listeners, we'll be discussing one such incident involving a strange, unexplained disappearance which occurred deep in the bowels of the so-called Bermuda Triangle. Was it caused by the paranormal happenings inside of this alleged triangle of doom? Or could there be a less exotic explanation afoot?
Fucking nailed it, man.
All right.
Just 4 months after the most devastating war in human history had ended, a mere blink of an eye by the historical standards, the world was collectively breathing a sigh of relief as the Axis powers were now a thing of the past. World peace had finally been achieved, and the war to end all wars had finally been concluded. Nothing could go wrong now, and the world was on its way to living happily ever after. A tsunami of optimism was now washing over the entire Western world, as millions of young men were now heroically returning home and impregnating their wives and girlfriends, which the entire baby boomer generation was born from. Shortly after 2 p.m. on the 5th of December, 1945, five TBM Avenger torpedo bombers departed U.S. Naval Air Station Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for a routine navigational training flight. During pre-flight, the five aircraft were fully fueled, but it was discovered that none of the aircraft had clocks, but the ground crews shrugged it off and assumed that all the crew had watches. Lieutenant Charles C. Taylor, a seasoned pilot with the U.S. Navy with some 2,500 flying hours and multiple World War II combat tours in the Pacific, was acting as the flight leader. So, according to an Unsolved Mysteries episode with Robert Stack, Lieutenant Taylor actually requested to be taken off the flight for not feeling well enough that day, but was ordered to go up because there were no other instructors available to take his place. And some people actually speculate that he might have been hungover from drinking the night before. But that's not something that's confirmed. The pilots of four other Avengers were Captain Edward J. Powers, U.S. Marine Corps, Ensign Joseph T. Bossy of the U.S. Navy, Captain George W. Stivers, USMC, and Second Lieutenant Robert J. Gerber of the Marine Corps. So just to provide a little bit of context here for those of you who aren't familiar with the different ranks of the different military branches. A Navy lieutenant is the equivalent of a Marine Corps captain, and a Navy ensign is the equivalent of like a Marine Corps second lieutenant. So it might sound weird that a lieutenant would be in charge of the flight instead of a captain, but the context is that those two ranks are actually equivalent to each other. It's just that the Navy and the Marines have different names for the ranks. So
It would be different if they were all Navy, because in the Navy, a captain is well above a lieutenant.
Correct. So I saw one source claim that Captain Stivers outranked Lieutenant Taylor, but that's not true because they were actually the same rank. It's just that the Navy and the Marines call that rank different names.
Yeah, that's so, 03, I think. 03,
yeah.
Hey, look at that. I remembered. Introduced into the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps in 1942 and famously flown by George Bush Sr. during World War II, and even Paul Newman was a rear gunner on one during World War II, these planes were designed for swooping down toward enemy ships or ground targets, releasing the payloads, and then returning back to their base or aircraft carrier. Paul Newman, huh? I did not know Paul Newman was a rear gunner on an Avenger.
He actually wanted to become a pilot, but he was colorblind, so he was relegated to being a rear gunner on one.
Well, at least he got to fly.
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, the Avenger had a large bomb bay, allowing for one Bliss Leavitt Mark 13 torpedo, a single 2,000-pound bomb, or up to four 500-pound bombs.
Kyle, can you kind of describe what these things look like for our listener?
Well, so let's see if I can put this in a way. So this is a single prop fighter bomber type thing, you know. So if anyone's watched World War II movies, you know what the planes look like. You have one propeller on the nose. Your wings are below the body or fuselage. This is a little longer and bulkier than your average World War II fighter because it's meant to carry a heavier payload, you know, a large torpedo or a large bomb or four slightly smaller bombs. The cockpit canopy is longer too to account for one, your pilot, and then two, your rear gunner, a guy that sits behind the pilot with usually a 50 cal or a 30 cal machine gun that sticks out the back of the cockpit.
But actually these things have three crew members on each.
Oh, they do?
Yes. So they have the rear ball turret gunner in the rear, and then they've got a guy who acts as the radio operator and I think another gun that kind of points down below the body of the aircraft.
On an Avenger?
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Is it bullshit? That's what my understanding was.
You know what? I'm sorry. I have to check you on this, and I thought I had this already up. But no, yeah, there's no... Oh, look at that. There is a ball gunner in the back. I don't think there's a lower gunner, though.
That's what Paul Newman was. He was the ball gunner on one.
Yeah. Well, it said rear gunner, you know, and so I just imagine like some other World War II bombers that there was just like an open window in the back. I didn't realize it was an enclosed ball, like the ball in the belly of a B-17.
All right, well, this is fucking with me, so we've got to check that. Can you check this? Can you Wikipedia Avenger?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, and it's plain as day. There is a ball turret in the rear. I thought they were wide open in the back.
No,
maybe that's.
But I'm talking about the guy in the middle. What was the guy in the middle? My understanding was that he's both a radio operator and a second gunner. Folks, just bear with us for a moment. We got to figure this out.
Three crew members, pilot, turret gunner, and radioman, bombardier, ventral gunner.
Well, there you go, man. Yeah, but anyway, in a nutshell, it's a big, beefy boy of an aircraft.
Oh, yeah, look at that. Under the tail. The middle seat, man. Had a port under the tail in which to stick what was basically a handheld 30 cal machine gun.
There you go, man.
To just throw rounds out the asshole of the plane. just shitting bullets on enemies should they try to get below them.
Well, that's a good way of putting it.
Wow, I had no idea. Like I was a huge fan of World War II military aircraft when I was growing up, and I thought I knew everything about everything when it came to World War II planes. Didn't know that. I did not know an Avenger had a middle seater, and I also did not know that middle seater could just stick a gun out essentially the bottom of the plane.
Well, now you know.
All right. Well, I'm sorry for calling bullshit on something that was not bullshit.
So anyway, man, these things, they weren't designed for plane-on-plane combat, usually. Two of the crew members were there to operate defensive guns, as we just said, but that's about it. So their purpose was geared more towards anti-ship warfare, and during World War II, they were credited with sinking 30 submarines, along with sinking the Japanese battleships Yamato and Musashi. The Yamato being the largest and the most powerful ship in world history up until that point. and the plane performed a pivotal role in its sinking. So we arguably couldn't have even won the Pacific Theater without this aircraft.
Agreed.
So anyway, let's move on with our story here. The group of aircraft, dubbed Flight 19, were to execute navigation problem number one, which was formally described as the following. 1. Depart 26 degrees 3 minutes north and 80 degrees 7 minutes west and fly 91 degrees T distance 56 miles to Hen and Chicken Shoals to conduct low-level bombing. After bombing, continue on course 091 degrees T for 67 miles. 2. Fly course 346 degrees T distance 73 miles. And 3. Fly course 241 degrees T distance 120 miles. Then returning to U.S. Naval Air Station, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. End quote. So, in a nutshell,
what is the T?
I think that stands for distance. It's been a while since I've studied this shit, but I think that stands for distance. The mission was to fly to the east from the eastern Florida coast, conduct bombing runs at a place called Hens and Chicken Shoals, then continue flying east, turn north, then proceed over the Grand Bahama Island out into the ocean to the north, before then turning back southwest, which formed kind of a triangular flight path back to their home base of NAS Fort Lauderdale. The weather was projected to be relatively normal, except for a few scattered showers. Wind speeds were expected to be normal for a training exercise of this nature, and the seas below were considered moderate to rough. And as we said earlier, this flight consisted of 5 TBM Avenger torpedo bombers, which consisted of 3 crew members, you know, the pilot, as we mentioned earlier, the radio man slash ventral gunner, and then a rear turret gunner. 4 of the Avengers, though, consisted of all 3 crew members, with the exception of the plane piloted by Second Lieutenant Robert J. Gerber of the Marine Corps, who was short a crew member, which then brought the total number of men on this flight to 14 instead of 15. Lieutenant Taylor, although he was the leader of the flight, was to be trailing the rest of the aviators as an observer. So, in other words, the flight wasn't following the leader was following the flight.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
It's a training flight.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the story. December 5th, 1945. Just about 20 minutes into the flight, around 2:30 p.m., Lieutenant Taylor and his flight made it easily to Hen and Chicken Shoals, where practice bombs were dropped successfully. All was normal at this point. By 3 p.m., one of the student pilots, unclear which one, dropped his last bomb before the flight attempted to make the second leg of their journey. It was after this point where things started to get funky. The following account of events comes from an article on history.navy.mil. At around 3:45 p.m., Fort Lauderdale's tower received a message from Lieutenant Taylor, who, instead of requesting landing instructions, sounded confused and worried. Quote, "Cannot see land. We seem to be off course," end quote. "What is your position?" the tower responded. After a few moments of silence, tower personnel peered out into the clear day in the direction of where the planes were supposed to be operating, but there was no sign of them. Quote, "We cannot be sure where we are. Repeat, cannot see land," end quote, Taylor radioed.
Contact was lost for about 10 minutes until the voice of one of the other crew members of the flight was heard saying, quote, "More like a bunch of Boy Scouts lost in the woods than experienced airmen flying in clear weather," end quote. Lieutenant Taylor was then heard again, quote, "We can't find west. Everything is wrong. We can't be sure of any direction. Everything looks strange, even the ocean," end quote. I wonder what he meant by that, "everything looks strange, even the ocean."
No, he was in the upside down. He was in some parallel universe where the ocean was grape jelly.
Just looked weird. The tower operator then learns, to his surprise, that Lieutenant Taylor has handed over his command to another pilot for an unknown reason. At around 4 p.m., a radio message was intercepted by another instructor pilot who was leading trainees on the exact same training mission, which was likely between one of the aircrew and Captain Powers. On the recording, one of the aircrew asked Powers for a compass reading, to which Powers replied, quote, "I don't know where we are. We must have gotten lost after that last turn," end quote.
The instructor of the other flight, Lieutenant Robert Cox, radioed in and asked them to identify themselves so that someone can help. Lieutenant Taylor was heard saying, quote, "Both my compasses are out, and I am trying to find Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I am overland, but it is broken. I'm sure I'm in the Keys, but I don't know how far down, and I don't know how to get to Fort Lauderdale," end quote. Lieutenant Cox of the other flight suggested to Lieutenant Taylor, put the sun on his port wing, which is left side, for those of you who don't know, if he's in the Florida Keys, and then fly up the coast toward Miami, and then 20 miles onward to Fort Lauderdale.
So, just for context here, it seems that Lieutenant Cox's call sign was FT-74, and Lieutenant Taylor's call sign was FT-28. Cox was within radio range of both the tower and the lost airmen of Flight 19, but Flight 19 was not within radio range of the tower. So Lieutenant Cox was trying to relay messages back and forth between the tower and Flight 19 at this time. So Taylor believed that they were over the Florida Keys, which would have been way off course from where they were supposed to be at this point. Like, their planned route would have been hundreds of miles to the east of Florida, and then the Keys are in like the southwest. So he's clearly super confused and turned around here. Taylor radioed to Cox, quote, FT-74, can you have Miami or someone turn on their radar gear and pick us up? We don't seem to be getting far. We were out on a navigational hop, and on the second leg, I thought they were going wrong, so I took over and was flying them back to the right position, but I'm sure now that neither one of my compasses are working, end quote. So I think this is pretty telling, because he makes the assumption here that his compass isn't working, because he's super positive that he's over the Florida Keys. So during the exchange between Flight 19 and the tower, via Lieutenant Cox, Fort Lauderdale instructs Cox to tell Flight 19 to have a pilot with a good compass take over the lead and guide them back to the mainland.
Lieutenant Taylor then radios to Cox, stating, quote, "One of the planes in the flight thinks if we went 270, we could hit land, 270 meaning due west." Taylor went on to say, quote, "We went out on a heading of 120. On the second leg of the hop, I took over because I thought they were going wrong. But now I know it's my compasses that were wrong," end quote.
Yeah, so here's another sign that Taylor made a navigational error, like either due to a compass malfunction or he's just blaming his compass. We don't know at this point. So at 4:56, Taylor was asked to turn on his transmitter for YG if he had one, but did not acknowledge the message. By 5 p.m., the shortened winter day began to come to an end, and the skies began to darken. Worse yet, they were beginning to lose radio contact as they flew further east. So again, here, just to recap at this point, flight leader Lieutenant Taylor believes they're somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico, and so he orders everyone to start flying northeast and then due east, believing that they're going to reach Florida that way. But if they were really in the Gulf, this would have taken them back to land pretty quickly, but that's clearly not where they are. So the entire flight gets lost, and this error just pushes them out further into the Atlantic Ocean, like up shit creek without a paddle. During research for this episode, I found that so many different sources conflicted with each other, and I couldn't compile a streamlined version of events in my head. So in trying times like these, I consulted the world's most trusted source of information, Wikipedia, to fill the void. So the following comes from Wikipedia. Kyle, why don't you go on from here?
You got it. Base operations then asked if the flight leader's aircraft was equipped with a standard YG IFF transmitter, which, in case you don't know, IFF, I believe, is identify friend or foe. It's something that they came up with in the early days of radar to figure out, you know, if something was beyond visual range, if it was friendly or enemy.
Correct.
So the IFF transmitter could be used to triangulate the flight's position, but the message was not acknowledged by FT-28. Later, he would indicate that his transmitter was activated. Instead, at 4:45, FT-28 radioed, quote, "We are heading 030 degrees for 45 minutes. Then we will fly north to make sure we are not over the Gulf of Mexico," end quote. During this time, no bearings could be made on the flight, and IFF could not be picked up. Taylor was told to broadcast on 4805 kilohertz. This order was not acknowledged, so he was asked to switch to 3,000 kilohertz, the search and rescue frequency. Taylor replied, quote, "I cannot switch frequencies. I must keep my planes intact," end quote. Well, that doesn't make any sense.
I'm not sure about that either.
Unless he means like in contact, like if he switched frequencies, he wouldn't be able to communicate with his own flight.
I think that's what he meant, but still, like, yeah. I don't understand why he would not do that.
At 16:56, that's 4:56 p.m., Taylor was again asked to turn on his transmitter for YG if he had one. He did not acknowledge, but a few minutes later advises flight, quote, "change course to 090 degrees for 10 minutes, end quote.
That's due east, by the way.
About the same time, someone in the flight said, quote, "damn it, if we could just fly west, we would get home. Head west, damn it," end quote. This difference of opinion later led to questions about why the students did not simply head west on their own. It has been explained that this can be attributed to military discipline. Yeah, follow orders first, ask questions later.
Yeah, pretty much.
As the weather deteriorated, radio contact became intermittent, and it was believed that the five aircraft by this point were more than 200 nautical miles, or 230 regular miles, out to sea, east of the Florida Peninsula. Taylor radioed, quote, "we'll fly 270 degrees west until landfall or running out of gas," end quote, and requested a weather check at 1724. By 1550, several land-based radio stations had triangulated Flight 19's position as being within 100 nautical miles radius of 29 degrees north, 79 degrees west. Flight 19 was north of the Bahamas and well off the coast of central Florida. At 1804, Taylor radioed to his flight, quote, "holding 270. We didn't fly far enough east. We may as well just turn around and fly east again," end quote. By that time, the weather had deteriorated even more and the sun had set. Around 1820, Taylor's last message was received. It has also been reported that Taylor's last message was received at 1904. So, big time discrepancy there of about 45 minutes. He was heard saying, quote, "all planes close up tight. We'll have to ditch unless landfall. When the first plane drops below 10 gallons, we all go down together."
Wow. All right. So, that's a lot to unpack there. So, basically, what is known is that they were not near the Keys. They were confirmed to have been out over the Atlantic the whole time. So Taylor was completely wrong, and it seemed like all the rest of the airmen knew that he was wrong, but they just didn't dare defy his orders. So while out over the Atlantic, it's getting late, they're flying further east out to sea, when he has like a sudden change of heart and decides that, yes, you know, we're going the wrong way. So he decides to turn back west, like all of the other students are saying, but they're way the fuck out there by this point. And they don't have enough fuel to make it back to the mainland. So several radio stations were able to triangulate their position to be within about 100 nautical miles of 29 degrees north, 79 degrees west. And this coordinate is about 120 miles to the east of Daytona Beach, Florida. So Taylor, according to all the information that I could gather, was dead wrong about where he thought that they were. And not only was he wrong, he was way off. So now they're facing the very real possibility of having to ditch their aircraft into the ocean at night, which I can't even imagine the amount of panic and terror that would fucking cause me if I was in one of those planes.
Yeah, pitch black. The weather's turning to shit. The sea was already moderate to rough when the sun was up. Yeah, you know. So yeah
and trying to land in the ocean at night in the pitch black. Yeah. Fuck that.
Yeah, this isn't the calm, picturesque Miami day at the beach.
No. Yeah, dude, if I was one of these students, I would be so fucking pissed off at him. Like, I'd wanna strangle him, dude.
Yeah.
So just to put things into perspective here, to successfully ditch the aircraft at sea, I'd say that the odds of surviving that are lower than they are of just being killed in the attempt. So you're basically opening up all the canopies, you've got the flaps down, the gear up, and you're trying to make contact with the ocean as flat as possible and as slow as possible. But if you were to hit a wave or you nose down at the wrong moment, or you just get unlucky, you might nose down into the water and just crash the plane. You know, the cockpit could crumple, your legs could get trapped, and then you have no chance of getting out. So, you know, basically, Taylor, he's ordering that whenever the first aircraft in the flight gets to 10 gallons of fuel, they're all going to ditch into the sea at the same time together. So
when he says ditch into the sea, I don't think he means like attempt a belly landing on rough seas. I think he means that they all pick an altitude and everyone climbs out of their cockpit with parachutes on and bails.
No, ditching means basically crash landing into the ocean.
Really? I thought ditching meant the same thing as bailing. You just ditch the plane. You jump out.
No, I think what he means is that they're all going to try to land in the ocean.
That seems impossible because it's pitch black and rough seas.
Yeah.
So another bad call by Flight Leader Taylor.
I don't know, man, but parachuting would also present its own challenges too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, you know, like a belly landing in the middle of the day on calm seas is tough and dangerous enough because you're going to slow down real quick the moment you make contact with the water. Now you're talking, it's dark, possibly pitch black, and the seas are rough. It's not flat at all. Like it's almost guaranteed death.
No, I mean, stuck between a rock and a hard place, dude. I mean, what else are you supposed to do in this situation?
I don't know. Maybe stop following orders.
That's too late for that if they don't have enough fuel to get back home anyway.
Yeah. All right. Continuing on. Tragically, the disappearance and assumed death of these 14 aircrew would not be the last. Naval Air Station Fort Lauderdale's museum website wrote the following. The pilot's ultimate fate was never determined, nor was the fate of the 13 other men sent out to search for their lost colleagues. Within minutes of learning of the squadron's predicament, two PBM Mariner flying boats were dispatched from NAS Banana River in Melbourne, Florida, now Patrick Space Force Base. Oh, the Space Force Base.
Yeah, I think that used to be Patrick Air Force Base, and when they made the Space Force, I think that transferred over to the Space Force.
Yeah. So, two PBM flying boats carrying rescue equipment take off from Banana River. Yep. Less than half an hour after takeoff, at approximately 7:27, one of the PBMs, Trainer 49, radioed the tower that they were nearing Flight 19's last assumed position. The rescue plane with a crew of 13 men was never heard from again. Theories abound on this loss. It is known that the SS Gaines Mills reported seeing an explosion at sea off New Smyrna Beach at 7:50 p.m. and what appeared to, quote, to be an airplane falling, end quote. The ship also observed a widespread oil slick while it fruitlessly searched for survivors. The weather was becoming stormy by the end of the incident. So,
wow. All
up.
Right. They deployed like a seaplane to go look for them, but then the seaplane just inexplicably disappears, and it's assumed that it just exploded in midair.
Yeah, right about where it reaches what they think is Flight 19's last known position.
Correct. Yeah. This PBM-5 Mariner Trainer 49 flying boat was lost with 13 men during the rescue mission. The Mariner was sent from NAS Banana River, as we said. According to Wikipedia, the PBM could hold 9.83 tons of aviation gasoline. Its flexible fuel lines had a noted tendency to get loose in rough conditions and leak gasoline. It's likely 59225 had experienced detachment of fuel lines off the engines, the leaking fuel getting in contact with hot engines, fuel fire, and an ensuing explosion. The wreckage and crew from this was also never found, aside from an oil slick. So, can you imagine getting accepted into pilot school? It's like your fucking dream come true, and then the Navy sticks you into that fucking death trap.
Well, it happens. At least you're not a B-17 ball gunner.
Yeah, fuck.
I think that was the shortest life expectancy of any position of any military in World War II. You know, yeah.
I'm going to have to take your word for it.
Dude, I think it was like the average life expectancy of a B-17 ball gunner was 5 days.
I'll take your word for it, man.
I remember reading that a long, long time ago.
I'll trust you on that. In the years since, the wreckage of several Avengers have been discovered in the vicinity and then disappointingly been found to not belong to Flight 19. For example, during the search for wreckage of the Space Shuttle Challenger in 1986, a submarine discovered the wreckage of an Avenger off the Florida coast. However, it was determined to have been from an unrelated incident.
It's pretty wild that they don't even find wreckage from these things, you know, because, aircraft metal is pretty light. It's pretty light aluminum, and it typically floats, you know.
Let's say that they all successfully ditched into the sea together and like intact, and it didn't spread out debris. In other words, like what I'm saying is, let's say they ditched the aircraft successfully and it didn't come apart, right? Eventually it's just going to sink to the bottom with trace.
That does make sense, you know, because you have a enclosed thing that can take on water, and it'll suck the whole plane down. Yeah. But the PBM potentially explodes into a gajillion pieces in midair. Like you think you'd find wings, flaps, something, you know.
Seat cushions.
Yeah. Yeah, because like, everyone in a plane, especially if you're in a Navy plane, you're flying over water, everyone is equipped with multiple flotation devices, things that are designed to not sink.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's keep trucking along then. Lieutenant Dave White, who was a senior flight instructor at NAS Fort Lauderdale, later recalled the incident. For the next 3 days, White, his assistant instructor, and 20 of his students flew up and down the Florida coast at low altitudes, but couldn't find a trace of the airmen or the wreckage. He became convinced that the planes rammed into rough seas about 60 miles east of Daytona Beach. Quote, "I don't think anybody got out of their planes at all. I don't think anybody survived," end quote. He likened hitting the ocean at high speed to hitting a brick wall. White remains mystified, as he mentioned. Quote, "The leader was an experienced combat pilot. These were reliable planes in good condition, and it was a routine training mission. We were alerted to look around the islands and to keep searching the water for debris. They just vanished. We had hundreds of planes out looking, and we searched over land and water for days, and nobody ever found the bodies or any debris," end quote.
All right, man. Well, I guess that kind of brings us to the end of the story, but not to the end of our mystery. So let's go over some of the most common theories. So this first one is the one I like to call the SpongeBob hypothesis. In a season one episode of SpongeBob SquarePants entitled "Arg," SpongeBob, Patrick, and Mr. Krabs play a board game based on the legend of the Flying Dutchman, which involves an in-game treasure hunt. Mr. Krabs likes the game so much that he wants to go out on a real treasure hunt. At one point in the episode, Mr. Krabs asks Patrick, who has the compass, which way is east. Patrick then checks his compass and points in a direction, and then off they go, walking 10,000 paces. However, upon their arrival 10,000 paces later, no X is on the ground. Mr. Krabs, puzzled, says, quote, "Where's the X? Supposed to be right here, 10,000 paces east," end quote. To which Patrick Starr famously replies with the following.
"Oh, east? I thought you said west."
This seemingly innocuous yet deeply profound statement sparked a revolution in an investigative thought. What if Taylor thought they accidentally flew west instead of east? This could very well explain his apparent confusion and disorientation. In radio chatter between Lieutenant Taylor and Lieutenant Cox, Taylor stated that he believed he was over the Florida Keys based on the broken islands he saw below him. This might have confused him, causing him to believe that he went west instead of east. Although his compass may have shown him his heading as east, what he saw below him looked like the Florida Keys, which led him to believe that there was no way that his compass was giving him an accurate reading, and therefore confusion and distrust of his instruments caused a meltdown in judgment. In an episode of Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack, Flight 19 investigator John Meyer, who was an Army pilot in the Vietnam War, heavily researched the topic and came to the conclusion that Taylor believed that he was in the Gulf of Mexico over the Florida Keys, but in reality, he was actually 300 miles northeast of Taylor's estimated location, flying over the Abaco Islands in the West Atlantic. From the air, the two island chains look remarkably similar. Taylor ordered the flight northeasterly, then due east. Had they been out over the Keys, this route would have taken them safely home. Instead, it just took them out further to sea. According to Meyer's theory, Lieutenant Taylor eventually listened to his students and ordered the flight to head due west. But by the time they were 7 minutes away from the Florida coast, the first plane went down, and then the remaining four pilots then made a fatal error. Although they were 7 minutes away from the coast, they still had not spotted land and began to believe that they must be in the Gulf of Mexico. So again, they reversed course and headed back east, but instead of going to Florida, this just took them back out to sea. So basically, in a nutshell, it was kind of like a case of analysis paralysis. Taylor and the other pilots, they kept flip-flopping about where they thought they were, and they're basically flying back and forth until they ran out of fuel.
Yeah. Not something you can do when you're up in the air, you know, to just get lost because, you're not just going to stall out on the shoulder and wait for a tow truck to come get you. Yeah, man. Yeah, if only they had Google Maps back then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy's official theory, a 500-page Navy Board of Investigation report published a few months later, made several observations. First, Flight Leader Lieutenant Charles C. Taylor had mistakenly believed that the small islands he passed over were the Florida Keys, that his flight was over the Gulf of Mexico, and that heading northeast would take them to Florida. It was determined that Taylor had passed over the Bahamas as scheduled, and he did, in fact, lead his flight to the northeast over the Atlantic. The report noted that some subordinate officers did likely know their approximate position, as indicated by radio transmissions stating that flying west would result in reaching the mainland. As noted in the report, Taylor refused to change the radio training frequency to search and rescue frequency. The training frequency was difficult to use because of interference from Cuban radio stations and also a radio carrier wave. Taylor was not at fault because the compasses stopped working. The loss of a PBM-5, BU number 59225, was attributed to an explosion. This report was subsequently amended to cause unknown by the Navy after Taylor's mother contended that the Navy was unfairly blaming her son for the loss of 5 aircraft and 14 men, when the Navy had neither the bodies nor the airplanes as evidence. Had Flight 19 actually been where Taylor believed it to be, the flight would have made landfall with the Florida coastline within 20 minutes, depending on how far down they were. However, a later reconstruction of the incident showed that the islands visible to Taylor were probably the Bahamas, well northeast of the Keys, and that Flight 19 was exactly where it should have been. The Board of Investigation found that because of his dogmatic belief that he was on a base course toward Florida, Taylor actually guided the flight farther northeast and out to sea. Further, it was general knowledge at NAS Fort Lauderdale that if a pilot ever became lost in the area, to fly a heading of 270 or due west. Likewise, a rule of thumb was that any pilot who got lost going south would simply turn his plane around with the sun on his port left side and then follow the Florida coast heading north. By the time the flight actually turned west, they were likely so far out to sea that they had already passed their aircraft's fuel endurance. This factor, combined with bad weather and the ditching characteristics of the Avenger, meant that there was little hope of rescue, even if they had managed to stay afloat. Oh, so you're right. Yeah, ditching in this case did mean to...
almost certain death.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, it did mean to belly land the plane on the water instead of jump out of it.
Exactly. So anyway, it kind of sounds like the Navy's theory is very similar to the SpongeBob theory. So my bad. All right, next theory. The quote, I'm not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens theory. One cannot mention the Bermuda Triangle without giving an honorable mention to the underwater bases of our alien overlords, which allegedly lay somewhere deep beneath the surface of the ocean under the Bermuda Triangle, secretly plotting and scheming to do whatever it is that they do. From the Gulf Breeze UFO flap of the 1990s to the mysterious objects that the more recent Navy pilots have spotted coming up out of the ocean, which we covered in episode 15 of this podcast, the area is famous for the inexplicable disappearance of 50 ships and 20 aircraft. With that said, it begs the question, could this be aliens? Ancient alien theorist and guy who allegedly uses alien jizz as hair gel, Giorgio Tsoukalos, probably thinks so.
It is so funny every time you say that. Another theory is the magnetic anomaly theory. In an article from airtechsolutions.com. Thank you. Sometimes it's tough to read that without spaces. In an article from airtechsolutions.com from June 2022, they wrote the following about the Bermuda Triangle. It is an area of hurricane formation and confluence of maritime currents, with which there are usually painful conditions for maritime navigation. But what about airplane navigation? Aren't instruments useful for flying over storms or circumnavigating hurricanes? And it is right at this point where the magnetosphere comes into play, that the layer formed by the interaction of Earth's magnetic field and the solar wind. It extends above the ionosphere, about 500 kilometers in height, protecting life on the surface from the arrival of ionizing radiation from the sun, and also from a part of cosmic rays, and diverting charged particles toward the magnetic poles, which causes the aurora borealis and aurora australis. I didn't know there was another aurora.
It's just north and south.
It is, along with the exosphere, one of the outermost layers of the atmosphere and one of the most important, since without it, life on Earth would practically not be possible, or would be very different from how we know it. But let's go back to the important thing, to our triangle. What does it have to do with the magnetosphere? Well, its link is due to the fact that the magnetosphere, in addition to the Earth's poles, as we have mentioned, has other re-entries that a priori... So what's a priori?
Anyways, keep going.
A priori do not have an easy or unifying explanation in current physics. That is, there are anomalous.
Come on.
Why did you give me like this super scientific thing to read?
I'll take over. God damn
you
it.
You got like the shortest thing.
That is, there are anomalous areas where the solar wind, cosmic radiation, and other peculiarities that do not occur elsewhere on the planet, except at the poles, can occur there. And the most famous area is over Brazil, relatively close to the Bermuda Triangle. Radiation levels or ionizing events can be observed with greater probability at lower altitudes, if we compare it with the European, North American, or Asian regions. Thus, certain aircraft instruments, such as magnetometers or gyroscopes, especially digital ones, can be affected by excess radiation and throw incorrect readings, disturbing the trajectory of the aircraft or inducing errors to pilots. And hence, a possible explanation for some of the possible cases of disappearance of passenger aircraft in these regions that, unfortunately, it is more than likely that they had a bad behavior or reading of their instruments, causing a drift in navigation that took them to the desired airport or leaving them without fuel in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. End of excerpt. You want to finish this off here?
Yeah, let's see if I can not butcher this last paragraph. In fiction, Flight 19 is featured in the 1977 science fiction film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. In the film's opening, the aircraft are discovered in the Sonoran Desert, in pristine condition with full fuel tanks, one of several mysterious events that imply extraterrestrial activity. In the film's ending scene, the crew returns to Earth from the alien mothership, seemingly the same ages as their disappearance. Flight 19 also made an appearance in the 2006 direct-to-DVD movie Scooby-Doo Pirates Ahoy.
Well, man, are you ready to try and solve this sumbitch once and for all?
Let's do it.
All right, man, what do you think about this? You, just for the record here, you came into this mystery completely blind without any research done. So what are your initial thoughts about the case?
My initial thoughts before even reading into anything was, you know, unexplicable, maybe extraterrestrial anomaly because of how many ships and planes have gone missing without a trace in the Bermuda Triangle. Mm-hmm. But after reading through this and getting a lot of information, I do like the magnetosphere theory. And I have heard about this before, that compasses tend to get wonky in the Bermuda Triangle, causing planes to get lost. Along with your theory of a flight leader was probably hung over for this, attributing to just poor decision making. You know, mm-hmm. I think that he just had a lapse and forgot where he was, assumed he was somewhere else, and just started leading his flight all over the place till they ran out of fuel. The only odd part is not finding any debris, because I don't think there is any way that all five of those aircraft, probably not even one of them, could successfully belly land in those conditions without smacking the water and just, you know, exploding into a bunch of pieces.
Well, here's the thing, man. I don't think that's too strange. I think that if they managed to actually belly land the aircraft, but then they weren't able to get out successfully from the aircraft. Let's say that all five were able to do that. I think something that could happen in this case is that the planes, they hit the water and then they flip over and then they sink. I think it's quite possible that something like that could have happened. Or it's just, they might have been in a different area. You know, it's possible that any of the search and rescue aircraft just missed them. You know, I see what you're saying, but I think it's possible that they were just missed or the plane sank in one piece.
I'll give more credit to that the planes went down somewhere else than where they thought they were, and that's why
quite possible too.
No wreckage was found, but you have five planes successfully landing in dark, rough conditions without breaking apart and then all flipping over before any of the 14 pilots could escape. That sounds like a stretch.
I'm going to backtrack and I'm going to say, yeah, that is strange. I think five aircrafts crashing, something should have been left on the surface, but
yeah.
It's possible that they missed it.
Yeah.
You know, or they were in a slightly different location from where they thought they were.
Yeah. The other weird part is the search and rescue aircraft, because they knew exactly where that thing was, mm-hmm. and it apparently exploded. I mean, granted, this happened at night, so they couldn't search till the next morning, but yeah, they didn't find any pieces of that either.
Yeah, but they did. There was a ship that saw a fireball in the sky. Yeah. So it is assumed that it didn't just like fly out into the twilight zone or something.
Yeah.
It did explode. So that's pretty much confirmed. So this one, man, it's not much of a mystery to me. I think what happened was that Taylor trusted his eyes instead of his compass. And he mistook the Abaco Islands for the Florida Keys. And this caused him to believe that both of his compasses weren't working properly. So believing that he was in the Keys, he decided to just fly northeast to get back to mainland Florida. And then all that did was take him out further to sea, like further into the Atlantic. And I hate to say it, man, but I think this incident was entirely his fault. He had way more experience than the rest of the pilots. And it seemed like even they were getting pissed off and frustrated, because even they knew just to fly west to get back. But he was stubborn. Like, he was convinced that he was in the Florida Keys, and he fucked them, man. He just fucked them all.
Yeah, he did.
And, you know, against their better judgment, they stuck with him because, hey, he's the one with 2,500 hours of flight experience, and he's the one who's in charge of this flight. We got to stick with him. And I think that's exactly what happened. If any of you are interested in this theory, an Unsolved Mysteries episode with Robert Stack is on YouTube. If you search for the Bermuda Triangle, this guy, John Meyer, he came up with a really good theory. He came up with this theory, and I looked into it, and I want to say I agree with him pretty much 95%. Do you have anything else to add, man?
I don't think so. I do like that theory. You know, I think we've, you know, concluded that, Taylor made a series of errors that cost him and his entire flight their lives and their planes. You know, still strange that no evidence of it has ever been found, you know, all these years later. You know, people are always diving and scanning the seafloors out there looking for old wrecks and stuff. And the fact that they haven't found a single one of those planes is still odd to me.
It is odd, but I mean, what can you do, man? It's just sometimes you miss it. I mean, the Atlantic Ocean's fucking huge, and you're looking for a needle in a haystack anyway. So
this is true.
To me, it's not that strange that they didn't find anything. All right, man. Do you have any apologies, shout outs, or clarifications you'd like to make before we go?
I apologize for butchering my last part just horrendously. I was
embarrassing.
Very ill prepared to read all of those technical words. This is what I get for not reading the script before recording. I thought I could just wing it. You know, we've done enough of these. I can just, you know, shoot this one from the hip. And it was going okay till the end right there. So I do apologize for that absolute embarrassment.
I accept your apology.
Thank you.
Real quick, I'd like to just give a shout out to listener Alex for writing us that 5-star review and then requesting this topic. That's about all, though. Are you ready to get out of here, man?
Yes, sir.
Like sands through the hourglass, so too are the minutes of our podcast. But don't fret, dear listener. We'll be back again to breathe new life into an old mystery next time.
Remember, folks, the truth is out there, somewhere in the ether, and through our powers combined, we'll solve that sumbitch once and for all.
This is Super Mystery Bros. Nothing could go wrong now, and the world was on its way to living happily ever after. A tsunami of optimism was now washing over the entire Western world. Jesus Christ, man.
Why did you run the dishwasher before we started recording an episode?
I didn't. Hold on, let me see if I can shut this shit off. Jesus Christ.
Dude, that is one intense sounding bidet you got there in the background. Like a fire hose in that thing.
I unplugged it.
No stop button, no pause, no cancel. Just straight unplug it from the wall.